This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Mind's Eye.
Welcome, listeners, to the Christian Science Monitor News for Monday, April 13, 2026. I'm Mark Stangle for Mind's Eye, translating vision into audio. Today's first article is a Christian Science perspective from Jennifer McLaughlin. It's entitled, Cause Me to Hear. I've always loved the Book of Psalms in the Bible. Many of the verses in these psalms, these sacred prayers, are instructional, inspirational, and comforting. Authentic in voice and relatable in tone, they are just as accessible today as when they were first sung. And there's great value in letting these prayers guide us in our own prayers to God, as well as in how to think about the world and our place in it. One such psalm relates to how God, Spirit, one of seven biblically based synonyms for God, guides our steps and cares for us. The following passage captures this idea beautifully. Cause me to hear thy loving kindness in the morning, for in thee do I trust. Cause me to know the way wherein I should walk. When we read or pray with this memorable verse, we are calling on God directly, specifically, and with expectancy of being heard and answered. It is an engaged prayer of obedience. We're asking God to cause us to hear, to be sure we hear, what? His loving kindness. What a precious thing to ask to hear. Who among us doesn't want to have a clearer, more consistent sense of the ever-present love and tender care God bestows on all? In thee do I trust, trusting God enables us to expect to hear and to hear the Christ, which is God's timeless message of loving kindness, and not only in the morning, but all day and all night too. It's natural for us to trust God, our infinitely good divine parent. The psalm continues with another request. Cause me to know the way wherein I should walk. Nurturing a purer, more trusting sense of God's presence and loving kindness enables us to hear what direction we should take or what decision we should make. Mary Baker Eddy, who founded the Christian Science Monitor, wrote in her textbook, Self and Health, or Science and Health, with key to the scriptures, having no other gods, turning to no other but the one perfect mind to guide him, man is the likeness of God, pure and eternal, having that mind which was also in Christ. Also, along with spirit, mind is another Bible-based synonym for God, who created us in his spiritual image. We reflect his wisdom, goodness, and love. When we yield to divine spirit, divine mind, we find that God is always guiding us, and that we are innately capable of following his leading. At one point several years ago, I was particularly praying with this verse, and what most stood out to me was the first part of it, cause me to hear. If there is cause, there is naturally effect, because God is all in all and all good, as Christian Science teaches. We can expect to hear God answer us when we pray to better understand his nature. All day, I found myself turning to God in prayer with these profound words in my thought. Small decision to make, cause me to hear. Big decision to make, cause me to hear. And then I would listen to hear God's voice and feel his loving kindness. The more I prayed with this verse and brought it into my day, the more inspired I felt. A sense of peace and trusting quiet were my constant companions that day. So as we all go about our days and weeks and lives, we can turn to God, our ever-present guide. Expecting an answer, we will hear and can obey. The next article in your Christian Science Monitor News of Monday, April 13, 2026, comes from Stephanie Haynes, the print editor of the Christian Science Monitor. Her story is entitled, Finding Stories That Overcome Political Barriers. There can be a perception that clean energy is a democratic issue. Progressives, according to conventional wisdom, are the ones worried about the environment, advocating solar power and driving electric cars. Republicans, the same line of thought goes, are focused on oil. But this is not the story I found when I was the Monitor's climate and environment reporter. And it's not the story that writer Scott Baldoff found in his piece this week about the new MAGA push for solar. For years, conservative clean energy groups and activists have advocated low-carbon power sources, lobbying state and federal government officials to support this expanding technology. I regularly interviewed sources from across the political spectrum who are pro-solar and pro-battery. Those boosters who identified as conservative tended to be motivated not by a fear of climate change, but by a desire for energy abundance. American ingenuity, they believed, combined with rapidly expanding technology, could meet the power needs of the 21st century. Their vision included tapping into fossil fuels while also moving full force into solar, wind, and batteries, as well as nuclear and geothermal power. And like renewable power supporters from the progressive side, many conservatives worried that the politicization of certain energy sources would end up undermining the country's quest for energy security and economic prosperity, and therefore its long-term environmental sustainability. Now, Scott Wright's prominent conservative influencers are also voicing this argument. This matters not only to those worried about growing pressure on the country's energy and power infrastructure, and not only to those who are concerned about the impact of greenhouse gas emissions on the planet's complex systems. It matters because it shows how, in some of the most contentious issues of our time, it's possible for people to find common ground. These conservative commentators are saying they support renewables for basically the exact reasons climate activists have been shouting about it for years, says Scott Blanchard, the editor of this piece, who also spent years working on energy stories in oil and gas states. One of our goals at the Monitor is to find and highlight these places of commonality. These deep points of connection can bring about empathy and civility, even when there are lasting disagreements about policies and political outcomes. It is important to highlight individuals who take stands that appear to break ideological norms, Scott Blanchard adds. Their example can open doors for readers to have civil conversations in their own lives, opening the aperture of what positions are acceptable and breaking the constraints of political tribalism. The next article in your Christian Science Monitor News of Monday, April 13, 2026, is entitled, Some MAGA Influencers Are Taking a Shine to Solar Power. President Trump has shunned it, but political conservatives, including Newt Gingrich and Kellyanne Conway, say the movement should embrace it. And this article is written by staff writer for the Christian Science Monitor, Scott Baldiff. The solar industry became a target in the first year of President Donald Trump's second term, when his administration cut key federal tax credits, subsidies, and investments in solar power, as well as broader green technology initiatives. The Republican president's skepticism toward low-carbon energy, rooted in a combination of economic, aesthetic, and ideological objections, is well known. At the World Economic Forum held in January 2025, Mr. Trump boasted of terminating former Democratic President Joe Biden's ridiculous and wasteful Inflation Reduction Act, which, among other spending to support renewable energy, offered tax incentives to encourage solar power. Yet, as America's demand for electricity rises, expected to grow at a 2.8% compound annual growth rate over the next 15 years, some Republican influencers, such as former House Speaker Newt Gingrich and former Trump advisor Kellyanne Conway, who are still among the president's most ardent supporters, are encouraging him to adopt a more pragmatic approach to solar. The reason is simple. Supply and demand, they say, though Mr. Gingrich mixes in a touch of nationalism. Failure to meet the electricity demands of industry would slow business growth, just when futuristic technologies such as artificial intelligence are starting to boom. To remain competitive with China in AI, he says, America needs to expand its electric power generation by using every energy source available. History tells us that energy scarcity is the biggest threat to the American economy, Mr. Gingrich wrote in a recent opinion column in the right-leaning website The Daily Caller. We need more of everything, intentionally excluding vital energy sources, fuel-based or renewable reduces supply and drives up prices. This, harms families and businesses. This is not abstract economic theory. It is common sense. Solar grows despite a political divide. Historically, America's power grid has always been a pragmatic concern, though people at opposite ends of the political spectrum often disagree on how to ensure Americans get the power they need. The debate over climate change disrupted all that. In 2016, America, under President Barack Obama, joined 192 other nations and the European Union in signing the Paris Agreement to substantially reduce carbon emissions by 2030. Americans were divided. Conservatives said the agreement would damage America's economy, while liberals cited the overwhelming scientific consensus that climate change is happening and is primarily caused by human activity. How and whether to use low and zero carbon energy sources, such as wind and solar, moving away from fossil fuels, were at the heart of that partisan divide. But today, even amid disagreements, after a decade and a half of expansion, solar power accounts for 8.5% of the United States electricity generation mix, up from 0.1% in 2010. That is still well behind fossil fuels, which make up more than half of the United States energy mix. Fossil fuels have a powerful lobbying presence, spending about $150 million a year to advocate for oil, gas, and coal businesses. Even so, in 2024, wind and solar power together overtook coal for the first time in electricity production, with wind and solar at 17% and coal at 15%. I don't view energy as an ideological issue, but that's what it's been turned into, says Eric D. Larson, a senior research scholar at the Anlinger Center for Energy and the Environment at Princeton University. I think that maybe a concern is that if demand is outstripping supply, prices will go up, Professor Larson says. And rising prices translate into votes, typically. But also there is the recognition that if we want to stay ahead as a country at the cutting edge of a technology, and AI is going to be a big part of that, we need power. A boon to red state America? At the moment, there is little evidence that prominent Republicans touting solar will influence President Trump to change his mind on solar energy. His 2025 tax and spending bill, which phased out solar subsidies, passed the House along party lines, 218 to 214. Those entrusted with implementing Mr. Trump's energy policies are led by Secretary of Energy Christopher Wright, the founder and former CEO of Liberty Energy, a major fracking service company. He has called solar panels a parasite that provides only intermittent power. In a February 17, 2026 panel discussion, Mr. Wright showed no signs of wavering. "We got off track because of a wild misunderstanding, an exaggeration about climate change," Mr. Wright said at a conference at the French Institute of International Relations in Paris. "Climate change," he said, "is a real thing, but it's gotten so ridiculously out of whack that we have policies that have just driven up energy prices and driven deindustrialization and made our countries geopolitically weaker." Even so, a small number of Republicans with influence in the White House are publicly advocating that President Trump adopt it as part of America First policy and give solar energy another chance. Conservative podcaster Katie Miller, wife of Mr. Trump's Homeland Security Advisor Stephen Miller, recently made the case for solar energy on social media. Ms. Miller, a former aide to Elon Musk, has been publicly promoting solar energy and has noted that her former boss's company, Tesla, produces solar panels. She has stated she does not have a paid partnership with the clean energy groups she sometimes cites. Solar is now the dominant source of new United States power capacity and is on track to surpass coal in total installed capacity before the end of 2026, she wrote. 70 GW of new solar capacity is scheduled to come online in 2026-2027, a 49% increase in operating solar capacity from the end of 2025. Ms. Conway, a pollster and former Trump's senior political counselor, conducted a February 2026 poll of 1,000 registered voters in Arizona, Florida, Indiana, Ohio, and Texas on behalf of the pro-solar advocacy group American Energy First. Her findings? Solar power enjoys broad, durable, and increasingly intense public support, including among Trump voters. 8 in 10 respondents agreed when asked if solar energy should be used in the United States to strengthen and increase our energy supply. 3/4 of self-identified Trump voters agreed. More than 2/3 of the new solar plants built over the past 5 years are in states that the Republican Party carried in 2024, including Texas, Indiana, Florida, Ohio, Arizona, Utah, and Arkansas, according to a report by Wood McKenzie on behalf of the Solar Energy Industries Association. Artificial intelligence is booming, and if you look at where they are building data centers, it's in red state America, says Mark Fleming, president and CEO of Conservatives for Clean Energy in Raleigh, North Carolina. In the Carolinas, the combination of AI data centers and solar and wind farms has contributed to the property tax base. It's been a lifesaver for rural counties, Mr. Fleming says, and that has brought more conservatives to the clean energy cause. Neil Arbach, founder and CEO of the Hudson Sustainable Group and senior advisor to the conservative-leaning American Conservation Coalition, says that ideologues on both sides of the aisle miss the point. America's economic competitiveness depends on abundant, affordable power today. With the 2026 midterms approaching, the political stakes are clear. Voters will reward leaders who present credible solutions to keep the lights on and bills down, Mr. Arbach wrote in a recent opinion column. Ideological purity, whether hostility toward fossil fuels or toward renewables, will not deliver affordable energy. And all of the above approach is not ideology, it is economic realism. Samantha Gross, director of the Energy Security and Climate Initiative at the Brookings Institute, says that whether you are worried about climate change or not, solar energy is one of the easiest and fastest ways to get power. That is one reason why the administration shouldn't be rolling its eyes at solar power. The next article in your Christian Science Monitor News of Monday, April 13, 2026, is entitled, In Israel, Outrage Over Settler Violence in West Bank. And it's written by a contributor to the Christian Science Monitor, Shoshana Solomon. With missiles from Iran and Lebanon raining down on Israel and fighter jets striking Tehran, Lieutenant General Eyal Zamir, the Israel Defense Forces Chief of Staff, visited the West Bank to issue a warning over a surge of settler violence against Palestinians. Speaking to IDF officers, General Zamir's wording was strong and guarded at the same time. He did not refer explicitly to settlers as the perpetrators or to Palestinians as the victims, but he did say the offenders endangered Israel's security as well as its values. It is unacceptable that during a multi-front war, the IDF is also forced to confront a threatening minority from within. These are rioters who do not represent the greater population, he said in a statement. In reality, they endanger residents, security, stability, and our values as a people and as a state. According to Israeli rights group Yesh Din, 257 incidents of settler violence or harassment against Palestinians were reported across the West Bank in the first 25 days after Israel's February 28 attack on Iran. The incidents, spanning 116 Palestinian communities, include shootings, physical assaults, property damage, and threats. Settlers killed 6 Palestinians during that period, Yesh Din says. The remarks by General Zamir, handpicked as a loyalist by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, suggest an increase of tensions with the more extreme members of Mr. Netanyahu's coalition, with whom the military chief has already clashed over Gaza policies. Indeed, the general called on Israeli authorities to take action against the settler violence, urging them to stop it before it is too late. In doing so, he effectively pointed a finger at the Israeli police, the Shin Bet Security Service, and the coalition itself. The violence has been so extreme, it has drawn condemnation from politicians, rabbis, former security heads, educators, and former ambassadors and senior foreign ministry officials. In a post on social platform X, Rabbi Yehuda Gilad, who heads a yeshiva in northern Israel, condemned an attack on a nearby village in the West Bank as a pogrom. "The violence is a desecration of God's name and a distortion of the Torah," he told the Monitor. The next article in your Christian Science Monitor news for Monday, April 13, 2026, is entitled, "Kremlin Set to Silence Online Messaging Apps in Russia." And this article is written by special correspondent to the Christian Science Monitor, Fred Weir. In recent weeks, residents of Moscow have been hit by a wave of orchestrated internet and mobile phone disruptions, creating digital mayhem in some quarters. In addition, the government seems to be throttling or deliberately slowing down WhatsApp and Telegram, Russia's most widely used messaging apps, which the government wants to replace with a Russian-developed super app called Max. Officials hint that it is part of a shadowy electronic war with Ukrainian enemies, but some analysts worry it is a dress rehearsal for a plan to corral the country's formerly open digital space and expel foreign influences. Russia has long planned to establish a sovereign internet that can stand alone, says Sarkis Darbinyan, a digital rights cyber lawyer. The idea is that if the global West splits off Russia from the internet, then Russian authorities have the complete infrastructure and methods in place to keep a self-sufficient Russian internet working. Authorities have made little effort to explain the current flurry of disruptive measures, which are apparently countrywide. In Moscow, they have affected many businesses and have sometimes left people unable to book a taxi, pay with a bank card, or even make a phone call. The outages are so far localized and temporary, but unpredictable. Russia's media regulator has for years been trying to make social media obey increasingly strict national security laws. Foreign-based platforms like Facebook, LinkedIn, and X were blocked for refusing to house their data for Russian users on servers in Russia. Now, the agency is throttling foreign-based messaging apps, making them largely unusable for Russian internet users without a virtual private network. There is a bureaucratic battle over this. Many state agencies and lots of officials use Telegram in their work. Soldiers in the war in Ukraine depend on it, says Anton Merkurov, an independent media expert. But the Kremlin sees these apps as organizing tools for protesters and conduits for dissent. There seems little enthusiasm for Max, despite the fact that it performs all the functions of the other platforms that are under attack. Max is not doing well, says Mr. Merkurov. People don't want to use it. They know that what comes from the government is never good. The next article in your Christian Science Monitor news for Monday, April 13, 2026, is entitled, "Anonymous Market Moves Suggest Insider Trading." Reports of big payouts from market trades that appeared to foresee major actions by the Trump administration, potentially with insider information, are becoming increasingly common. In late March, the oil futures market saw a spike in trades just minutes before President Donald Trump announced a pause in plans to attack Iranian power plants. The unidentified trader or traders had placed more than half $1 billion in trades, according to the Financial Times. Similarly, the prediction market Poly Market saw a sharp increase in bets that proved lucrative right before the United States went to war against Iran and earlier invaded Venezuela. Critics say these well-timed, anonymous market plays strongly suggest insider trading. "This is just astounding corruption," Democratic Senator Chris Murphy of Connecticut said in a social media video. "People are making money off of their inside information, their access to what President Trump is going to do or what he is going to say. Senator Murphy, along with Representative Greg Kazar of Texas, has introduced a bill banning prediction markets from wagering on government actions, terrorism, war, assassination, and events where an individual knows or controls the outcome. But some experts say new laws won't fix the problem. Insider trading is already illegal, says Todd Phillips, an assistant professor of law at Georgia State University's Business School. Enforcement is the real issue, he suggests. Concern about conflicts of interest has put additional scrutiny on President Trump's soaring personal fortune, now estimated at $6.5 billion, up $1.4 billion from March 2025. A Department of Justice memo recently revealed that the classified documents Mr. Trump was charged with illegally retaining in 2021 in a case that was later dismissed were related to his business interests. To ethics experts, it underscores an alarming erosion in norms around profiting off government work or connections, norms that serve to reassure voters that public officials were putting the interests of the country ahead of their own. Today, just 17% of the United States public trust the federal government to do what is right for the country, down from 77% in 1964, according to Pew Research Center. This article was written by staff writer for the Christian Science Monitor, Linda Feldman. The next article in your Christian Science Monitor news of Monday, April 13, 2026, is entitled, Out in Space, Canada and the United States are getting along just fine. And this article was written by staff writer for the Christian Science Monitor, Audrey Thiebert. On the ground in Ottawa, Ontario, and Washington, Canadian-American relations are the worst they've been since the War of 1812. In space, it's a different story. Canadian astronaut Jeremy Hansen is expected to join three American colleagues for the much-anticipated Artemis II mission, a NASA milestone for moon exploration. Mr. Hansen will be the first Canadian and first non-American to go on a mission around the moon. The American-Canadian team will lift off at a time when the United States and Canada are caught up in a trade war. President Donald Trump has spent the past year threatening to annex Canada, and Prime Minister Mark Carney has become an advocate for middle powers, establishing new global partnerships from military to trade that exclude the United States. But those rifts have not yet divided the space arena. The two countries are together sending a crew to do what only 24 people have done before, leave low Earth's orbit. The 10-day mission, the first journey to the moon by astronauts since 1972, is a point of national pride for Canada, with its much smaller space program, and the United States. At a time of contentious geopolitics, it is also a moment to celebrate the wonder of exploration and working together to do so. The crew will include the first woman and person of color to ever fly around the moon, too. It's pushing a frontier, and that's what we do in exploration and discovery and science and research in general, says Julie Payette, veteran Canadian astronaut engineer and the former Governor General of Canada. We push that frontier of whatever the known world is, and at the moment the frontier we have as humans in terms of physics is the moon. She adds, they are doing it not solely for one nation or solely for one people. The entire Artemis crew is going out there for everybody on Earth. The next article in your Christian Science Monitor news from Monday, April 13, 2026, is entitled, With War Abroad, United States Faces Terror Threats Back Home. And this article is written by staff writer for the Christian Science Monitor, Patrick Janssen. As the United States began attacks on Iran in late February, the federal government braced for possible retaliation at home. To increase security, Hunter Army Airfield in Savannah, Georgia, joined hundreds of other installations in suspending the Trusted Traveler program at its main gate. Alerts then went out to the nation's 55 Joint Terrorism Task Forces, local law enforcement, and sensitive industries, reminding them that Iran and its proxies have the capability of striking the United States in retaliation for American strikes in the Middle East. Since the start of the war, the United States has sustained a series of small but deadly attacks, including a fatal shooting at a Texas bar said to be linked to recent Middle East violence. Then came an Iran-sponsored cyber attack against a Michigan medical equipment company. More concerns were raised by reports of unidentified drones flying over military bases, including the Washington area Fort McNair, where Secretary of State Marco Rubio and Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth are among the residents. The concerns have served as a reminder that entities opposing America, including Iran and its proxies, have the capacity to carry out asymmetrical warfare against United States targets. The FBI says that last year saw a 35% increase in counterintelligence arrests and multiple foiled terrorism plots. More specifically, United States counterterror agencies have discovered and stopped 17 Iranian-inspired plots in the past 5 years, according to the Combating Terrorism Center at West Point in New York. The FBI, in a statement to the Monitor, declined to answer whether staff shakeups have affected agency readiness. But the FBI continuously assesses and realigns our resources to ensure the safety of the American people, the statement read. Since President Donald Trump took office, the FBI, the nation's main counterterror organization, has seen several high-level firings and resignations, including 10 to 12 agents and staff from a New York counterintelligence unit that specializes in Iran threats, tracking foreign spies, and investigating plots to assassinate United States officials. FBI Director Kash Patel ordered the dismissals just days before the United States launched Operation Epic Fury, with Mr. Patel alleging the agents took improper investigative steps in a court case about Mr. Trump's handling of classified documents. "I'm worried that we're taking qualified people and picking fights with one another across party lines rather than making sure we protect ourselves and keep ourselves safe," says Democratic Representative Chrissy Houlihan of Pennsylvania during a recent hearing. The next article in your Christian Science Monitor News of Monday, April 13, 2026, is entitled, "Social Media Companies Will Appeal Rulings That They Harm Teens." Within the space of 24 hours, tech giant Meta lost two landmark court cases in two states related to the alleged harms of social media for children. In a Los Angeles lawsuit, a jury found on March 25 that Meta and YouTube's negligent designs of their social media platforms were a substantial factor in causing harm to the mental health of a young woman. The day before, in a separate case in New Mexico, a jury concluded that Meta misled consumers about the safety of its platforms and enabled child exploitation. The case was brought by the state's Justice Department. The verdicts could open the way for similar lawsuits by other states and individuals. Meta said it would appeal both cases. In the Los Angeles trial, the 20-year-old plaintiff, identified only by her first name, Kaylee, testified that she began using Google's YouTube at age 6 and then Meta's Instagram 3 years later. At issue was whether YouTube and Instagram are addictive. Kaylee's lawyers claimed that the platforms hook children by design. The jury voted 10-2 that Meta was negligent in its design, that this neglect was a significant factor in causing harm to Kaylee's mental health, and that the company knew of the dangers Instagram poses to children. At least 9 of the 12 jurors had to agree for the companies to be held liable. Meta and YouTube were ordered to pay $3 million, 70% and 30% of that amount respectively, to the plaintiff. Meta has argued that Kaylee's challenges predated her use of social media. It also touted safety features, such as parental controls, teen accounts, and age-related restrictions for our mature content. YouTube said its data showed that Kaylee's usage of the site declined over time. Celebrating his state's win in the other case, New Mexico Attorney General Raul Torres called the jury's verdict a historic victory for every child and family who has paid the price for Meta's choice to put profits over kids' safety. And this article was written by staff writer for the Christian Science Monitor, Stephen Humphreys. The next article in your Christian Science Monitor News of Monday, April 13, 2026, is entitled, "Anthropic's Court Win Highlights Ongoing AI Safety Debate." And this article is written by staff writer for the Christian Science Monitor, Caitlin Babcock. A federal judge has temporarily blocked the Pentagon from labeling AI company Anthropic a supply chain risk. The legal development came amid the Trump administration's efforts to punish the artificial intelligence firm after it refused to let its technology be deployed in fully autonomous weapons or for surveillance of Americans. United States District Judge Rita Lynn said in a ruling that the broad punitive measures appeared arbitrary and capricious. The dispute has brought long-standing tensions between national security and the ethical development of AI into the national spotlight. It also represents the latest instance in which AI's swift integration into business and government has collided with growing concerns that its development is leaving safety protocols behind. In late February, Anthropic refused to allow the Pentagon unrestricted use of its technology, insisting on limitations it said were essential for safety. The Defense Department had used the company's technology in operations to seize Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro in January and in the Iran strikes that began on February 28. The Pentagon responded to Anthropic's demand by designating the company a supply chain risk to national security. After negotiations fell apart, Anthropic's competitor OpenAI signed a deal with the Pentagon with less stringent restrictions that Anthropic had sought. Anthropic has sued the Trump administration, saying its action was unlawful. The next article in your Christian Science Monitor News of Monday, April 13, 2026, is entitled, Inconsequential Vote, Hungary Weighs Illiberal Democracy. Viktor Orban and his Fidesz party have held office for 16 years. A reform-minded lawyer backed by frustrated young voters might soon end that streak. And this article is written by special correspondent to the Christian Science Monitor, Dominique Sogol. It might have been a gray, rain-battered evening, but that wasn't going to stop potential voters keen to see the man who could unseat Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban, one of the European Union's most entrenched and controversial leaders. Young voters stood alongside curious parents and grandparents, all eager to hear Peter Magyar, lawyer and dynamic leader of the Tisza party, as he barnstormed through this riverside town just north of Budapest. A former government insider turned critic, Mr. Magyar represents the most credible threat to Mr. Orban to date. Mr. Orban and his conservative Fidesz party have been in power since 2010, but a string of scandals combined with economic pressures driving down quality of life and young Hungarians to go abroad have left them both on the defensive ahead of Hungary's April 12 parliamentary elections. Analysts say the opportunity for change is real. The things that are happening are unprecedented in Hungarian history, says Balz Veto, an analyst at the Farás Institute for Social Research. The challenger to Fidesz is a movement that hardly existed 2 years ago, yet now commands a level of support no opposition force has achieved before, he adds. If this continues, there is a real chance that Peter Magyar could win. Hungary at a crossroads. Hungary under Mr. Orban has come to define what he himself calls an illiberal democracy. Observers say the country is marked by widespread corruption and entrenched nepotism, shrinking media freedoms, and a steady consolidation of power. Since 2010, the Fidesz government has reshaped the electoral system to its advantage. It has redesigned constituency boundaries and installed a single-round winner-take-all system in parliament. It has also granted voting rights to ethnic Hungarians abroad. Despite all this, polling data shows Mr. Magyar's center-right Tisza party in the lead ahead of the election, with clear margins in every age bracket under 60. That could mean an electoral system designed to favor Fidesz could be turned against it. Mr. Magyar frames the vote as a choice between East and West, playing on public concerns about a potential Brexit-like departure from the EU. Mr. Orban has repeatedly clashed with Brussels over issues ranging from the rule of law to Russia's war in Ukraine. This is a referendum, Bals Tothmar, the TISA candidate in Szentendre, told the Christian Science Monitor. We should decide whether we should stay in the EU or choose another option. A lot of youngsters understand that and try to support us. A youth movement. Indeed, the party's reformist edge is sharpest among younger voters. Surveys show that only 10 to 12% of young voters would back Fidesz, compared with about 60% for TISA. With nearly 500,000 first-time voters eligible to vote in a country of just less than 10 million, this age group could prove decisive. What is very special about TISA is that it has widespread support among young people, says Mr. Vito. We are talking about young people who grew up under Fidesz but are digitally active and see clearly. Things are better elsewhere. Vince Loki, a 23-year-old who was raised in Szentendre but studies in Budapest, wonders why Hungary, with its high sales taxes, lacks the modern rail and public transport systems found in other European cities such as Vienna. To get to class, he takes a rundown train into the capital, a daily reminder of the gap. I would vote for this tree if it means ousting Fidesz, he says, indicating vegetation nearby as he waits for a train. The only thing Fidesz didn't ruin is what they didn't touch. Mr. Loki studied international business economics and English, largely as an exit strategy should Fidesz remain in power. At home, money was tight. His mother, a biologist and teacher, struggled to make ends meet despite working full-time. He took a construction side job while in high school to relieve financial pressures. His experience reflects broader pressures on the Hungarian economy. Since the pandemic, inflation has surged, while wages lag behind Western Europe. Disputes with Brussels have led to the suspension of billions of euros in EU funding for Hungary, limiting investment. Public services have declined under tighter budgets, and Hungarians across age groups have noted the decline. People don't want miracles, but normal life, Mr. Magyar said at the rally in Szentendre. They want disinfectant in the hospitals, teachers at the schools, and decent roads. The young shouldn't have to leave their country. Economic frustrations. Mr. Magyar has been tapping into a deep well of economic discontent. In 2024, he took over and rebranded the once marginal TISA party, turning it into a political force. His reformist message has resonated with disillusioned voters across the political spectrum. Hungarians have grown frustrated with both a ruling Fidesz and a fragmented, ineffective opposition, according to analysts and lay people alike. When I hear Mr. Magyar speak, I tell myself, this is it. This is the guy who can win, says Suzanne, a sociologist who only gave her first name. Whenever he goes to campaign, he knows the problems of the local area and has solutions in mind. He has surrounded himself with good advisors. Mr. Magyar presents himself as a technocrat. He is credited with recruiting and fielding candidates based on merit rather than party loyalty. And unlike previous opposition candidates, his conservative background might help him win over older voters, even those who voted for Fidesz in the past. My grandparents are willing to change their vote so my life gets better, says Rika Vinko, who studied tourism and is frustrated by economic stagnation and lack of employment opportunities. She says her parents are not so accommodating. They flatly tell her to leave the country if she's so unhappy. Accusations abound. Mr. Magyar is focused on the scandal stalking Fidesz to reinforce the momentum of his campaign. The latest to make waves are allegations reported by the Washington Post that Hungarian officials shared sensitive EU information with Russia, as well as claims that Hungarian intelligence services targeted Fidesz's political opposition. But Mr. Magyar's own rise is tainted by controversy, too. He shot to fame in 2024 during the fallout from a controversial presidential pardon. Ultimately, both Hungary's president and the justice minister at the time resigned amid public outcry. Mr. Magyar left Fidesz and loudly criticized party leadership, including the justice minister, who was his ex-wife, during the scandal. Critics in the Fidesz camp argue that this shows a betrayal of personal and political trust on Mr. Magyar's part. Fidesz billboards depict him as a two-faced man. Being heard. Ms. Vinko says she is not entirely sold on Mr. Magyar, but she is still willing to give him a chance and vote accordingly. Though her parents have always urged her to steer clear of politics to avoid trouble, she joined her friends at a rally for Mr. Orban, hoping it might be one of his last. That impression was reinforced by loud booing at multiple campaign events for the prime minister, even in small towns that have in the past voted for Fidesz. For Ms. Vinko, it comes down to feeling seen and heard. She chafes at the government's view of society that rewards childbearing and leaves little room for women outside traditional roles. If you don't have a child, you don't count, she says. I don't want to have a child in a situation that is so uncertain. I'm really hoping Mr. Magyar wins. If it doesn't work out, I want to leave. The next article in your Christian Science Monitor news for Monday, April 13, 2026, is entitled, With Left-Wing Star Power, Could AOC Seek White House? New York Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, some observers say, could position herself as a young, charismatic underdog in a 2028 run for president. And this article is written by contributor to the Christian Science Monitor, Aaron Short. In the hours after the United States first struck Iran on February 28, Democratic Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez put out a statement that was characteristically blunt. This war is unlawful, it is unnecessary, and it will be catastrophic, she wrote. Her full-throated denunciation stood in contrast to the carefully calibrated messaging from Democratic leaders in Washington, who sternly criticized President Donald Trump for failing to seek congressional authorization, but also condemned Iran as a bad actor with dangerous nuclear ambitions. And it helps explain why Ms. Ocasio-Cortez is increasingly seen by many insiders as a serious contender for the Democratic presidential nomination in 2028. At a time when many Democratic voters are looking for leaders who will push back forcefully against President Trump, Ms. Ocasio-Cortez's brand as an outspoken change agent may hold appeal. With fellow Democratic Socialist Senator Bernie Sanders not likely to mount another White House run, there's an opening in the left-wing, anti-establishment lane if the former bartender from New York wants it. The 2028 campaign won't officially begin for another year or so, but not-so-subtle maneuvering is already taking place. Many Democratic White House hopefuls are visiting early primary states, peddling political memoirs, and raising money for local candidates. Ms. Ocasio-Cortez has not engaged in such overt signaling and has generally deflected questions about her political future. But the New York Congresswoman has positioned herself for a possible run. Last year, she joined Vermont Senator Sanders on a nationwide fighting oligarchy tour that drew huge crowds. She also made some shrewd endorsements, including New York Mayor Zoran Mamdani, another Democratic socialist who rose from obscurity to pull off one of the biggest political upsets in recent history. It was a similar upset that catapulted Ms. Ocasio-Cortez onto the national stage in 2018, when she beat 10-term Democratic Representative Joe Crowley, a member of the House leadership, to become the youngest woman ever elected to Congress. She quickly became a darling on the left and a villain to the right, criticizing the status quo and pushing for progressive policies. Now she's arrived at a kind of crossroads. Longtime observers and people in the four-term lawmaker's orbit say she is carefully considering all her options. She could remain in the House and keep working her way up the seniority ladder, using her social media megaphone to steer her party. She could mount a primary challenge to New York Senator Chuck Schumer, the Democratic leader whose approval ratings have fallen as his party has languished in the minority. Or she could take an even bigger risk and run for president, offering herself as a young and charismatic underdog with fresh ideas and online savvy at a time when the nation will be coming off its two oldest presidents ever. AOC conceivably fits in the Obama lane as an outsider, says former New York Representative Anthony Weiner. The base is excited by her. She gives good speeches. Paradoxically, he adds, she may benefit by being underestimated. She is seen as not having enough experience and is not being taken super seriously except by outsiders. Nowadays, having less of a record is better than having more of a record. In national and early primary state surveys of whom Democratic voters would like to see as their next nominee, Ms. Ocasio-Cortez often lands in the top two or three. She is, without question, a polarizing figure, with policy preferences that put her to the left of the mainstream voter. But just as Mr. Trump moved the GOP in a more populist direction in 2016, the Democratic Party may be ripe for a takeover next year, particularly if frustrations with the war in Iran, rising health care and grocery costs, housing affordability, and Israel continue to build. We've seen progressives succeed at all levels across the country, says John Paul Lupo, a Democratic political consultant. She is the most electable progressive that we have, and she'd be foolish not to take a look at 2028. Playing the long game. Since coming to Washington as an inexperienced 29-year-old in 2018, Ms. Ocasio-Cortez has transformed from a brash newcomer to someone who seems to be playing the long game. She antagonized some of her new House colleagues before she was even sworn in, joining youth climate activists to occupy Democratic Speaker Nancy Pelosi's office that December. She partnered with Justice Democrats, a political action committee that recruits challengers to run against incumbents, including targeting newly selected House Democratic Caucus Chairman Hakeem Jeffries. Along with three other left-wing newcomers known as the Squad, Ms. Ocasio-Cortez amassed one of the largest social media followings on Capitol Hill and used that platform to voice displeasure with border security legislation and Speaker Pelosi's reluctance to launch impeachment proceedings against President Trump. Ms. Pelosi publicly panned the Squad's influence while privately telling them to tone down their tweets if they ever wanted to accomplish anything. Ms. Ocasio-Cortez seemed to heed the advice. Over the next 6 years, she became a skilled Washington insider, promoting progressive policies such as Medicare for All and the Green New Deal, while also contributing campaign funds to moderate Democrats in swing districts. She developed a friendly relationship with President Joe Biden, who adopted her agenda to reduce greenhouse gas emissions and expand health care access for millions of Americans. When other Democrats began calling on President Biden to suspend his reelection campaign after a disastrous debate performance in the summer of 2024, Ms. Ocasio-Cortez forcefully defended him. More recently, she has staked out positions on issues from online gambling to AI and privacy to data centers that have drawn approving comments from conservatives. Still, navigating the corridors of power on Capitol Hill doesn't guarantee a successful leap to a presidential campaign. In February, Ms. Ocasio-Cortez drew a slew of negative headlines after a high-profile stumble at an international security conference. In her first major foreign policy address, she told an audience of global leaders in Munich, Germany, that income inequality has fueled the growth of far-right populism, urging Europe's left and center-left communities to unite against it. But when asked about other topics, her answers were less assured. She called the transatlantic partnership the Trans-Pacific Partnership, said Venezuela was below the equator, and paused for an excruciatingly long time when asked how the United States should respond if China invaded Taiwan. The criticism was so scathing that the congresswoman was forced to respond with a phone call to the New York Times. To some, it was evidence of the greater scrutiny and higher standards that female candidates often encounter compared with male rivals. AOC has to avoid the ambition trap. Women of politics, particularly women of color, get seen as being impatient, says Christian Amato, a campaign strategist from the Bronx. At the same time, he adds, she has one of the clearest defined arcs to grow out of any candidate. The Senate option. In the wake of the Democrats' 2024 electoral losses, when the party belatedly pushed its 81-year-old president out of the race, only to lose the White House to Mr. Trump and be shut out of power on Capitol Hill, generational tensions have continued to grow. That winter, Ms. Ocasio-Cortez mounted a bid for ranking member of the House Oversight Committee, but lost out to 8-term Virginia Representative Jerry Conley, who died 6 months later. She declined to seek the position a second time, telling reporters the underlying dynamics in the caucus have not shifted with respect to seniority as much as I think would be necessary. Since then, the clamor from Democratic voters for a new generation of leaders has only gotten louder. A number of younger candidates are challenging veteran lawmakers in primaries. Much of the base's ire has been directed toward New York Senator Chuck Schumer, whose popularity has dwindled to its lowest level in 25 years. Last November, after 8 Democratic senators voted with Republicans to end the longest government shutdown in history without securing any real policy concessions, several House Democrats called for his removal as minority leader. Ms. Ocasio-Cortez blasted the decision to end the shutdown, but sidestepped questions about Mr. Schumer. Asked whether she would consider running for a seat when it comes up in 2028, she said only, "That is years from now." Still, some Democratic insiders see it as a strong possibility. Mr. Amato says Ms. Ocasio-Cortez has been building authority on a range of issues, including civil liberties, executive overreach, and tech abuses. If she decides to challenge Mr. Schumer in a primary, he says, she will be well positioned to do so. Her behavior suggests, "I don't want the seat if it's handed down," he says. She wants optimal conditions that make a different kind of leadership necessary. Mr. Schumer has not yet said whether he plans to run for re-election, but many speculate he will, especially if Democrats take control of the Senate in 2026. Still, the minority leader has been losing support for much of the past year. Only 27% of statewide voters think he is doing an excellent or good job in office, according to a February Marist poll. Ms. Ocasio-Cortez topped him 48% to 34% in a head-to-head matchup among New York City voters surveyed by the Honan Strategy Group in December. Bradley Honan, the New York pollster who conducted the survey, says Ms. Ocasio-Cortez would be a formidable Senate candidate, but he believes her ambitions run higher. The leadership role she's played in the party, holding rallies with huge turnout at a time when Democrats are feeling disaffected, I think she is looking past the United States Senate race, which is hers to lose, and very seriously considering a presidential bid, he says. Then there's the Mamdani effect. The splash electoral success of Mayor Mamdani on the heels of 2 grassroots-powered presidential runs by Senator Sanders may give Ms. Ocasio-Cortez a boost in scaling up a campaign, tapping into a network of consultants and workers. Gustavo Gordillo, co-chair of the New York City Democratic Socialists of America, said he is hearing a lot of excitement among his political organization's members for another Democratic Socialist candidate for president. "Bernie's campaign was so helpful for working people in this country, even though he didn't win," he says. "I think that we're hungry for another bite at the apple." Next, in your Christian Science Monitor news of Monday, April 13, 2026, it's numbers in the news. The numbers 6 and 10. The share of Asian Americans, Native Hawaiians, and Pacific Islanders who say President Donald Trump has hurt rather than helped immigration and border security, according to a new poll. About 2/3 of this group also think Trump has gone too far in deporting immigrants who are living in the United States illegally. The number 56, the percentage by which the United Kingdom will slash its aid budget by 2028-29, resulting in a £900 million, $1.2 billion reduction in bilateral aid to Africa. The reduction is part of a £6 billion, $8 billion U.S. in budget cuts that will fund higher defense spending in the United Kingdom. And you have just heard the Christian Science Monitor news for Monday, April 13, 2026. I'm Mark Stangle for Mind's Eye, translating vision into audio. Thank you for listening, and have a great week.